Hello, it's Debbie again, and today is Wednesday, February 10th, 2016. Reading from the E edition of the Herald, Decatur Herald and Review. Starting on the front page, looks like it has four good articles. Crime in Courts, two new top-notch canine teams for Decatur, says the headline. Decatur. Because police dogs have consistently proved they are valuable members of the force, the Decatur Police Department has expanded its canine unit to an all-time high number of teams. With the addition of two dogs and two handlers, the department will have a canine team on the street during each of its three patrol shifts, in addition to a team assigned to its street crimes drug interdiction unit. In the past 10 years, we've gone from three dogs in the county to seven, which is a much better place to be, said Decatur Police Sergeant Dan Wise, K-9 Unit Supervisor. Our K-9 teams respond to the highest priority calls. Other officers make very critical decisions, but not on an everyday basis like the K-9 units do, and usually not in such a spontaneous fashion as the K-9 units have to respond. As an example of the importance of the canine force, on January 14th, the Decatur police team was immediately sent to a Northside apartment complex to take part in the investigation of a homicide that had occurred in the parking lot. Officer Bobby Baker, who normally works the day shift but was the officer on call that night, quickly responded with his canine partner, Coy. K-O-Y, Coy, and search for a possible suspect and evidence. The investigation in that case remains open. Many defendants in crimes, including robberies, burglaries, and homicides, have been convicted with the help of police dogs and their handlers. For many years, Decatur officers have been working closely with the Macon County Sheriff's Office, which has three canine units, two assigned to patrol and one to explosives. The newest additions to the Decatur force, Rex and Aldo, were the first graduates of the Macon County Sheriff's Office Canine Academy, opened in 2015. Steve Josts, J-O-S-T-E-S, Josts, the Academy Director, retired in May after serving 28 years as a Decatur Police K-9 officer. Matt Kyle Daniels, an officer for 7 years who's been serving as the department's gang specialist, was selected as a handler for Aldo, a 2-year-old Belgian Malinois from Holland. Chris Snyder, an officer for 4 years whose family owned a kennel, is teamed up with Rex, a German Shepherd Malinois mixed breed from the Czech Republic. Daniels recently experienced a breakthrough moment with Aldo. After a man was shot and seriously injured in the 700 block of West Packard Street the night of January 12th, the team was deployed to the scene of the shooting. An article search turned up a firearm, the first one the team has found. Unfortunately, the celebration turned to a near tragedy when Aldo inadvertently dug his teeth into his handler's face and head. He got jacked up, recalled Daniels, who suffered wounds requiring stitches in his nose and eyelid, in addition to puncture wounds on the side of his head. We were both excited. Oh my God, it's a gun. After Aldo located the firearm in a tire, Daniel's objective was to reward him by throwing him a ball, which would also pull him away from the evidence. It took a weird bounce and came right at me, Daniel said. He just came after the ball with an open mouth and got me in the face. Daniel suffered lacerations beneath his eye and on eyelid, requiring stitches in addition to about a dozen puncture wounds on his face and head. Daniels was transported to the hospital for treatment, where he remained for 5 hours. He didn't bite down, Daniels said. If he did, I'd be missing half my face. Wise said it's not uncommon for a handler to get injured while training his dog or while on duty, but it is somewhat unusual to be injured in such an obvious location and so early in one's career. A dog doesn't have the ability to express his thoughts to you, Wise said, adding sometimes they might express distaste for a task by snapping at a handler. If you're training responsibly, it doesn't happen often and usually not serious. A dog might bite a handler if he zigs when he should have zagged. Daniels and Snyder were among about a dozen officers who applied for canine positions. They both showed interest in becoming canine officers a year early, attending a training session while off-duty to see if it was something they wanted to pursue. Snyder, whose family raised and trained hunting dogs, said he wanted to become a canine officer since he joined the department in 2011. "The canine unit was the best fit for me, where I would be happiest," Snyder said. On Snyder's first day on the street, he and Rex found a bag hidden under leaves in the woods containing about 64 grams of cocaine and 2 grams of marijuana, street value $6,500, along a route a suspect used to flee from police. That suspect was out on bond in a Class X armed violence case. In December, the team tracked a suspect who fled from a traffic stop to a dumpster on the Millikan University campus. Snyder said Rex is a very intelligent dog with critical thinking skills that are better developed than full-blooded Malinois because of his German Shepherd side. "He's the only half-breed we have in the department," Snyder said. "He has a little different personality than other dogs, a little more of a thinker. The rest of the dogs will obey commands without a second thought. He'll do it, but he'll do it in his own way." Daniel said that other dogs will knock down a wall to get where they're going, but Rex will open the door and enter the room. Rex might think there's an easier way to do this. Wise explained that a German Shepherd can think about two things at the same time, where a Malinois can only think about one. "He never backs down, but he's going to do it how he sees fit," Snyder said. "He's going to play the game on his terms." As an example of Rex's unique style, Daniels was wearing a padded suit, playing the role of a hiding suspect during training. The suit didn't prevent Rex from harming his prey. "Rex bit me on the hand," Daniel recalled. "Rex pulled my hand out of the sleeve." "Proven effectiveness," says the little headline. By the time he collided with his handler's face, Aldo had already proved his effectiveness in several cases. When called to investigate a vehicle at a traffic stop, Aldo signaled that there were narcotics inside. From that traffic stop, we seized just shy of $11,000 in currency, Daniel said. Rex and Aldo were purchased July 1st through a gift from the Howard Buffett Foundation. Their handlers were selected the following month. "The canine job is one of the most dangerous jobs on the police force," Daniel said, adding that several police dogs were killed this week across the nation. "But you always find something to show for your hard work. It's obviously the coolest job in the police department." With two of the canine unit's longtime officers, Jose and Steve Baldwin, recently retiring, that created two openings. Daniels and Snyder were thrilled when they were selected to fill those positions. "Many officers who aspire to work with dogs never get that opportunity. We are extremely lucky we started our careers exactly when we did," Daniels said. Wise said officers who work with dogs have to be cool under pressure and make the right decisions every time. "For most major crimes, there will be a dog on the scene," said Wise, who served as a canine handler for 13 of his 21 years on the force. "There are few very serious crimes that occur that a canine can't be used for something. Police canine units earn their own keep. The cost of the entire unit is run by drug seizures," Wise said. "It is paid for by the asset forfeiture that these dogs are participating in seizing. They play a large part in these seizures." Baker, who joined the canine unit in November 2014, said he joined the police department to be a canine officer. He's been in the department almost 4 years. "I love it," said Baker, who grew up around his grandfather's well-trained hunting dogs. "The highlights are finding people we track. It's the toughest thing we do. I get the most satisfaction out of tracking. It's the most fun I have. Every day we do real police work. It's what we want to do, look for bad guys and do real police work." Chad Larner, an officer since 2002, is the longest-serving police department handler after he was assigned to a canine unit in October 2014. He brought a wealth of experience with him, 11 years of training and selling police dogs to law enforcement agencies. Larner, a street crimes detective, was instrumental in selecting the two newest four-legged additions. He traveled to out-of-state kennels with Wise and other officers to find the best dogs. Larner said Rex was an impressive find at a Cleveland kennel. Aldo was the outstanding dog at an Indiana facility. "With the canine corps composed of young officers, With the canine corps composed of young officers, unusual because often more experienced officers are selected. Wise is optimistic that we'll be a top-notch unit for years to come. Each officer pledges to remain in the canine unit for 5 years. Most complete their careers as canine officers. I feel we have a very good beginning to what will become a highly skilled and experienced unit in the coming years, Wise said. So far, they're beyond where they could be. They're improving their skills and abilities every day. End of this article. Continuing on the front page, an AP article on business, Obama unveils record $4.1 trillion budget. This is by Andrew Taylor and Martin Kritzinger of the AP. Washington. President Barack Obama on Tuesday unveiled a record $4.1 trillion election year budget that finances Democratic priorities like education, health care, and climate change with new taxes on crude oil, the wealthy, and big banks. The progressive wish list, which comes as the nation's long-term fiscal outlook is deteriorating, underscores the initiatives pushed by the Democratic candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, who hope to succeed Obama. Republicans dismiss the proposal as a tax and spend exercise. Obama called the budget, his eighth and final one, a roadmap to a future that embodies America's values and aspirations, a future of opportunity and security for all our families, a rising standard of living, and a sustainable, peaceful planet for our kids. The budget was unveiled on the same day as the New Hampshire presidential primary, with much of the focus on the political fight over Obama's successor. The budget calls for a major new tax on crude oil that would raise the price of gasoline, currently averaging about $1.80 a gallon nationwide, by about 24 cents. All told, its tax hikes would average more than $250 billion a year to cover deficits made worse by a softening economic picture. The $2.8 trillion net tax hike package would almost double the tax increases Obama sought and was denied last year. This isn't even in a budget as much as a progressive manual for growing the federal government at the expense of hardworking Americans, said House Speaker Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin. As in past years, Obama's budget largely leaves alone huge benefit programs like Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, and food stamps, whose spiraling growth is the main driver of budget deficits that economists say could drag down the economy unless policymakers step in. The Obama plan sees the deficit rising from $438 billion last year to more than $500 billion for the 2017 budget year that starts October 1st. Deficits over the coming decade would total $6 trillion. Obama and his GOP rivals long ago gave up on efforts to find sweeping bipartisan solutions to the government's eroding fiscal picture. An Obama proposal to curb the inflation increases for Social Security beneficiaries, seen as an overture to Republicans, was shelved years ago. Washington nonpartisan budget scolds were unimpressed. The president once promised not to leave our fiscal problems for future generations to solve. But in this budget, that's exactly what he does, says Maya McGinnis, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Well, virtually no one in Washington is predicting a major budget pact this year between Obama and Republicans. Administration officials saw bipartisan hope for proposals to combat heroin and opiate addiction, fund a moonshot effort to find cancer cures, and expanded tax credits for the working poor. The budget arrived the day after Obama requested an immediate $1.8 billion infusion to combat the Zika virus, which can cause horrific birth defects and is spreading in Latin America. It's tempting to adopt the conventional wisdom that a president's final budget isn't relevant, but I think the conventional wisdom is wrong, said Sean Donovan, director of the White House Budget Office. The submission caps a combative few years in Obama's dealings with Republicans. A major deficit reduction effort in 2011 fell apart, though, after his reelection in 2012, Obama won a higher income tax rate on couples earning more than $450,000 per year and individuals earning more than $400,000. A budget pact last year set overall spending levels for this year's round of agency spending bills. The budget proposes a 10-year, $400 billion initiative for clean transportation projects and other infrastructure, a $19 billion 35% increase for cybersecurity and additional funding for a summertime food program for children who receive free lunches during the school year. It also calls for a $4 billion plan to teach computer science and $6 billion in training funds to help young people land their first jobs. Other tax increases include a 0.07% fee on larger banks that would raise about $10 billion a year, reducing the value of itemized deductions taken by wealthier taxpayers to raise a whopping $646 billion over a decade, almost doubling the approximate dollar per pack federal cigarette tax, and a new proposal to require a greater number of wealthy people to pay a 3.8% Obamacare tax surcharge. The so-called Buffett rule would require a minimum 30% tax rate for upper income earners. Some of those tax increases would offset new tax cuts, such as expansion of tuition tax credits, giving the earned income tax credit for the working poor to those without children, and broadening a tax credit for child care expenses. Among the health care provisions in Obama's budget, several address the rising cost of prescription drugs. One new proposal would gradually shift most of the burden of paying for drugs in the catastrophic portion of Medicare's prescription program to insurers who deliver the benefit as opposed to taxpayers. Another idea, estimated to save $5.8 billion over 10 years, would allow the federal government to join forces with states to negotiate Medicaid rebates from drug companies. I think that's the end of that article. I'll double check here. Yep, moving on to the next one. Politics, Trump, Sanders, victorious in New Hampshire. This is by Julie Pace and Kathleen Ronayne, also AP writers. Manchester, New Hampshire. Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Bernie Sanders swept to victory in Tuesday's New Hampshire primaries, adding crucial credibility to their upstart candidacies and underscoring voters' insistence on shaking up American politics. Trump and Sanders entered Tuesday's contest as favorites in New Hampshire, but needed to deliver on expectations after second-place finishes in Iowa leadoff caucuses. Trump appealed to the voters seeking a political outsider, while Sanders was buoyed by those seeking a candidate who they felt cared about people like them. "Together we have sent the message that will echo from Wall Street to Washington, from Maine to California," Sanders said at a raucous victory party, "and that is that the government of our great country belongs to all of the people and not just a handful of wealthy campaign contributors and their super PACs." Hillary Clinton echoed Sanders' calls for taking on Wall Street banks and tackling income inequality, but cast herself as more prepared to make good on her policy pledges. "People have every right to be angry, but they're also hungry. They're hungry for solutions," she said after congratulating Sanders on his win. New Hampshire did little to clarify the crowded contest among more mainstream GOP candidates fighting to emerge as a challenger to Trump and Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who won the Iowa caucuses. Ohio Governor John Kasich claimed second place after devoting almost all of his campaign resources to New Hampshire, while Florida Senator Marco Rubio and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush battled for third along with Cruz. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who also staked his candidacy on New Hampshire, lagged behind the pack as voters were being tallied. Sanders pulled from a broad coalition of New Hampshire voters, gathering a majority of votes from men, independents, and voters under 45, as well as a slim majority of women. Hillary Clinton won the majority of those over 65 and those with incomes over $200,000 a year, according to early exit polls conducted by Edison Research for the AP and the television networks. Clinton's campaign argues she will perform better as the race heads to more racially diverse states, including Nevada and South Carolina. Both New Hampshire and Iowa are overwhelmingly white states that are far less diverse than the nation as a whole. The distinctions between what motivated Sanders and Clinton voters were sharp. The Vermont senator was backed by 9 in 10 voters for whom honesty was important, and 8 in 10 who wanted a candidate who cares about people like me. Clinton, meanwhile, won support from nearly 90% of those who considered the right experience important in their decision, and about 80% of those regarding electability as the most important factor. Both Sanders, a self-described Democratic socialist, and Trump, a real estate mogul who has never held political office, have tapped into the public's frustration with the current political system. Even if neither candidate ultimately becomes his party's nominee, whoever does will have to reckon with those factions of voters. Republican voters were more negative about their politicians than Democrats, with about half of GOP voters saying they felt betrayed by party officials. Trump carried a majority of those who said they wanted an outsider to win. Nearly half of the voters in the Republican primary made up their minds in the past week. However, Trump's support appeared more sustained, with his supporters saying they made up their minds some time ago. In a sign of Trump's impact on the race, two-thirds of GOP voters said they supported a temporary ban on non-citizen Muslims entering the U.S., a position the billionaire outlined last year amid rising fears of terrorism emanating from the Middle East. After finishing behind Cruz in Iowa last week, Trump embraced some of the more traditional trappings of presidential campaigns, including smaller town hall events with voters. Still, he closed the final full day of campaigning with a vulgar insult to Cruz. The Texas senator brushed off Trump's comments, saying the reason the businessman engages insults is, quote, because he can't discuss the substance. The large Republican field was winnowed after Iowa, but there remains a crowded grouping of more traditional candidates, including Rubio and the governors. Rubio had appeared to be breaking away after a stronger-than-expected showing in Iowa, but he stumbled in Saturday's debate under intense pressure from Christie. The New Jersey governor has relentlessly cast the young senator as too inexperienced and too reliant on memorized talking points to become president. Rubio played into Christie's hands by responding with the same well-rehearsed line each time he was challenged by the governor. Rival campaigns hoped the moment was enough to give voters pause. Kasich, Bush, and Christie all poured enormous resources into New Hampshire in hope of jumpstarting their White House bids in a state that has been friendly to moderate Republicans. All three could face pressure from party leaders and financial donors to end their campaigns without a strong showing. End of that article, which has a big picture of Vote 16 on it. And on to the last article from the front page of the Herald and Review. Government and Politics, Rahner Sets Average Goal for Illinois. This is by Dan Petrella, the Springfield Bureau Chief for the Herald and Review. Springfield. Speaking to business leaders Tuesday night, Republican Governor Bruce Rahner set a goal for Illinois. Let's be average. That was Rahner's refrain as he wrapped up a two-day tour of speeches to business groups around the state with an address to members of the Illinois and Greater Springfield Chambers of Commerce at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. We're among the worst on workers' compensation. We're among the worst on property taxes. We're dead last for state support of education, he said. On good things, we're last, and on bad things, we're a leader. And what I've decided to start doing is I'm going to say, let's be average. If average gets to the middle of the pack on those and other key issues, Rahner says we'll win because we've got better people in a better location, better infrastructure, more strategic assets. To blame for these problems are politicians, most notably the supermajority Democrats in the General Assembly led by House Speaker Michael Madigan of Chicago, the governor said. Right now, there's a titanic struggle for the future of our state, Rahner said. The question is, are we going to stay on the trajectory we've been on, which is one where we've been deficit spending, unbalanced budgets, more borrowing, more taxing, more job losses, more reduction in family incomes, more cuts to school funding, and ongoing conflicts of interest in government, or are we going to go on in a new, more positive direction, he added. Rahner says he is proposing reforms in four major areas to move the state in that direction: politics, government, economic competitiveness, and education. These include many issues he's been discussing since taking office last year, such as changing the way legislative districts are drawn and cutting workers' compensation costs and some more recent areas of emphasis, such as streamlining the way state buys goods and services. These changes would help the state's economy grow at a rate closer to the national average, Rauner said, adding that Illinois would have a balanced budget and no backlog of unpaid bills without tax increases if the economy had grown at that rate over the past 17 years. Illinois is now 8th month without a budget, a situation Rauner calls outrageous and unconscionable, and which he also blamed on Madigan and Democratic majority. Democrats blame Rauner for the impasse because he vetoed all but the elementary and secondary education portion of the budget the General Assembly approved. While they acknowledge the plan would have spent $4 billion more than the state expects to bring in, Madigan and the others have said that Rauner could have used his amendatory veto power to adjust it to his liking. Rauner has said he hasn't done that because it wouldn't address the root of the problem. If all we do is a little veto and a little bit of a tax hike and don't change the cause of the deficit spending, we won't fix the problem. We won't have balanced budgets in the future, he said. Todd Mache, president of Illinois Chamber of Commerce, said that while some businesses are feeling the impact of the impasse, members support the governor's reform efforts. And, well, let's be average might sound like a low bar. You got to get to average before you can get above average, Mesh said. End of the article. Closing part one, we'll get to the local section. School board airs concern about alternative education. This is by Valerie Wells from the staff. Decatur, though the consideration of a proposal to reconfigure alternative education was pulled from the Decatur School Board's agenda at its Tuesday meeting, board members discussed the need for it. During board discussion time after the agenda was completed, board member Dan Oakes cited figures he had requested from the district. In the years 2011-16, Oakes said the district had spent $2.7 million on alternative education. Between 2012-16, the program served 324 students, and only 8 of those graduated. To me, this illustrates a need to move forward to something that's a little more efficient, Oakes said, something that's better for the students and far more cost-efficient. The cost this year, Oakes said, is $360,000. How many other places could we put that, he said. How many teachers is that? What a waste of money. We need to be better with our money, and we need to get on it now. Board member B.A. Butts said the board needs to do whatever it can to help the Discipline Action Committee work out the details and complete all stakeholders in the process of deciding on a new alternative education plan. However, board member Alita Graham, a retired special ed teacher, objected to looking at the problem as one of money. I'm appalled reducing the care of children to dollars and cents. It's not about cutting funds to serve children who need it. I want to see the Decatur Public Schools have the best program we can have. Oakes said a more financially efficient program could serve more students and serve them better than one in which money spent was not producing better results than the one he cited. Board member Brian Hodge said he thinks it's more important to get a new program in place in time to begin the new school year in August. The board did not indicate when the issue would be placed to get on the agenda. In other business, the board approved a proposal to authorize the transfer of employment of other special ed education personnel from the Macon Piatt Special Education District to the district, which is a cost-saving member. Those employees will retain their salaries, seniority, and benefits. End of that article. End of part one of Wednesday, February 10th, 2016. We'll be back in a moment with part two.